A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headaches.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. So Hannah sent us something interesting this week. She's looking past the immediate smoke of the April 2026 conflict with Iran and asking about the neighborhood. Here is what she wrote. Following the latest war with Iran, which may or may not be ending, relations between Israel and both the Gulf states and Levantine neighbors may be changing. What does that mean for the future of these relations? And is there hope of expanding the Abraham Accords? Is there a real chance for a regional and modern alliance? It never really made sense that Israel was intertwined primarily with Europe, politically, economically, and culturally, instead of its neighbors. Is the dream of a modern, progressive, stable, and prosperous Middle East only a pipe dream? Will there ever be a weekend getaway by train to Beirut or Istanbul?
That is such a profound way to frame it. I am Herman Poppleberry, and honestly, Hannah is hitting on the tectonic shift that most of the legacy media is missing because they are so focused on the tactical side of the missiles and the intercepts. By the way, today's episode is powered by Google Gemini 3 Flash.
It is a bit wild, right? We have spent decades treating Israel like it is a lonely island that just happened to drift away from the coast of France and get stuck in the Levant. But if you look at the map, it is right there. It is the land bridge. And after this February and March escalation with Iran, it feels like the island strategy is finally hitting its expiration date.
It has to. The old model was strategic ambiguity and walking between raindrops, as we have talked about in the past. But the April 2026 conflict essentially broke the balance of terror. When you have direct state-on-state engagement of that scale, the middle ground disappears. You are either part of the regional integration project or you are part of the chaos. What I find fascinating is that while the headlines were all about the 2026 Iran war, the actual story might be the 2026 regional realignment.
You mean the idea that we're moving from a ring of fire to a defense tech corridor? That is a phrase I've been seeing pop up in a few research papers from the London School of Economics and Manara magazine lately. It suggests that the Abraham Accords are not just about luxury hotels in Dubai anymore. But wait. How do you go from firing interceptors at each other's drones to building a defense tech corridor? That feels like a massive leap in logic.
It's not a leap if you look at the shared data. During the April 2026 barrage, we saw unprecedented levels of intelligence sharing. When Iran launched those hypersonic batteries, the trajectory data wasn't just staying in a bunker in Tel Aviv. It was bouncing between Riyadh, Amman, and Abu Dhabi in real time. That corridor isn't a future project, it's the infrastructure that kept the lights on last month. The defense part is the shield, and the tech part is the proprietary AI that manages the sensor fusion across four different national borders.
So it's basically an automated neighborhood watch with high-grade explosives.
Well, not exactly in the sense of agreeing, but in the sense that the evolution is purely functional now. It is moving from ceremonial to existential. In the early days of the Accords, it was about tourism and maybe some flight paths. Now, in the wake of the 2026 conflict, it is about integrated early warning systems and shared missile defense. We are seeing reports of quiet coordination with Jordan and Egypt that would have been unthinkable 5 years ago. It is a security-first integration.
But let's look at the Levantine side of Hannah's question. The weekend getaway to Beirut part. That sounds like a pipe dream to anyone who has watched Lebanon over the last decade. I mean, we're talking about a country that has struggled to keep its own streetlights on, let alone manage a high-speed rail connection with a neighbor it's technically at war with. But then you look at the rise of the Aoun Salaam government in Beirut recently. Joseph Aoun and Nawaf Salam are being framed as the return of the state. Is that just PR, or is there a functional path there?
It is a high-wire act for sure. But the logic is economic gravity. Lebanon is essentially a failed state looking for an anchor. If the Ring of Fire, specifically Hezbollah's grip, is weakened by the fallout of the 2026 war, and we are seeing signs that their domestic support is cratering as the reconstruction costs mount, the vacuum has to be filled. The new regional strategy Israel is pursuing isn't just about winning a war, it is about creating a regional hegemonic opportunity. If you can integrate Lebanon into a Mediterranean energy grid or a regional rail network, the cost of them returning to the Iranian orbit becomes prohibitively expensive.
It is the Golden Arches, theory of conflict prevention, but with high-speed rail and natural gas pipelines. But does that actually work in the Middle East? We've seen trade partners go to war before.
It works when the dependency is absolute. Think about the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Forum. If Lebanon's only path to ending its 22-hour-a-day blackouts is through a subsea pipeline connected to Israeli fields, the political rhetoric starts to matter a lot less than the air conditioning. And look at Turkey. This is where it gets really interesting. Despite the rhetoric we hear from Erdogan, the underlying economic reality is massive. Turkey-Israel bilateral trade hit $8.5 billion in 2024. It is Israel's fifth-largest trading partner. Even during the height of the 2026 conflict, those ships were still moving.
That is the part that always kills me. The public speeches are all fire and brimstone, but the balance sheets are all business. It is like a long-married couple that screams at each other in the driveway, but has a perfectly functioning joint bank account. I saw a report that Turkish steel was actually being used in the construction of Israeli defensive fortifications during the war. Is that verified?
It's one of those open secrets in the logistics world. The supply chains are so deeply embedded that uncoupling them would be a form of national suicide for both economies. And now we have the World Bank approving $2 billion for the Istanbul North Rail Crossing project. This isn't just a Turkish project, it is a Middle East corridor project. They want to link Europe to Asia through the Yavuz Sultan Selim Bridge. If you connect that to the proposed rails through Syria and Jordan, you suddenly have a physical manifestation of this alliance.
Okay, but we have to talk about the elephant in the room. The grand bargain with Saudi Arabia. All the reports from Bloomberg and the Institute for National Security Studies say normalization is increasingly remote because of the Palestinian statehood requirement. Is MBS just waiting for the current Israeli coalition to change, or is there a deeper stagnation?
I think it is a wait-and-see approach on the formal signing, but a full-steam-ahead approach on informal integration. Think about the EAPC pipelines. Saudi oil moving through Israeli infrastructure is already happening in various capacities. The tech collaboration is happening. They had 12 rounds of talks in 2024 alone. The signing ceremony is the political prize, but the functional integration is the reality on the ground.
It reminds me of how big tech companies operate. They sue each other in court over patents while simultaneously signing multi-billion dollar deals for chips and screens. It's co-opetition.
That's a great term for it. It feels like we are moving toward a Middle East that looks more like ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. They have massive territorial disputes and historical grievances. Think about the South China Sea, but they decided that being poor and at war was less profitable than being integrated and annoyed with each other.
That is a perfect comparison. ASEAN succeeded because they prioritized economic stability over ideological purity. The question for the Middle East in 2026 is whether the shock of the Iran war was enough to force that same realization. Israel's finance ministry is projecting 3.3% GDP growth for 2026, which is wild considering they just fought a major regional war. That growth is predicated on the idea that the war cleared the path for these trade routes.
It's the creative destruction of geopolitics. But let's go back to Hannah's point about Europe. Why did it take a war for Israel to realize it's not in Europe?
Because Europe was a safe harbor. For 70 years, the neighborhood was too hostile to even consider. But the EU is struggling with its own energy crises and internal divisions. If Israel becomes the energy bridge for Gulf gas and oil to reach the West, the neighbors suddenly become more important than the customers in Brussels.
It changes the power dynamic entirely. Instead of being a client state of the West, Israel becomes a foundational pillar of a regional bloc. But let's get back to Hannah's train question. The missing link is about 127 kilometers of track through Syria and Lebanon. That is the hurdle. You can have all the World Bank funding in the world for Turkey, but if you can't get through Damascus, the train stops at the border.
Which brings us back to the post-conflict reality. Does Syria remain an Iranian outpost, or does the exhaustion of the 2026 war force Assad, or whoever follows, to look toward Gulf money for reconstruction? If the UAE is willing to put up $35 billion for investment in Israel and the surrounding area, that is a very loud carrot dangling in front of a very hungry Syria.
The UAE has already deployed $12 billion of that by the first quarter of 2026. They are not waiting for the ink to dry on peace treaties. They are buying the future. And that is what we need to unpack. What does this defense tech corridor actually look like on a Tuesday in 2027 or 2028? Is it just drones and sensors, or is it actual people moving across borders?
Let's dive deeper into that, because if the goal is a normal Middle East, we have to talk about the second-order effects. What happens to the Israeli economy when it isn't just Silicon Wadi, but the R&D hub for a Silicon Sands region?
I love that. Let's explore the actual mechanics of this integration, because if we are talking about a 40-minute episode, we have a lot of track to lay down before we reach Istanbul.
Right. So let's start with the immediate diplomatic fallout. We just came out of this massive flare-up in April. Most people expected the Abraham Accords to shatter under the pressure of a regional war. Instead, the UAE and Bahrain basically stayed the course, and Saudi Arabia was surprisingly quiet. Why didn't the whole thing collapse?
Because the threat model changed. For the Gulf states, the 2026 conflict proved that Iran was no longer a theoretical threat that could be managed through proxies. It was a direct, kinetic reality. If the Gulf states had abandoned their security ties with Israel during the war, they would have been left completely exposed. The defense tech corridor isn't a luxury, it is a survival strategy. We are seeing reports of shared early warning data that essentially saved major infrastructure in the Gulf from drone swarms during the February escalation.
So, it is a security-first normalization. You don't have to love your neighbor to realize you both have the same fire insurance policy. But what does that look like in practice? Is there an Israeli officer sitting in a command center in Riyadh?
Not officially, but the digital handshakes are constant. We're talking about interoperability. It's the same way NATO functions. You don't need every soldier to speak the same language as long as the radar systems speak the same code. Once you have generals and intelligence officers talking every day to prevent missiles from hitting desalination plants, it becomes much easier for the trade ministers to start talking about rail gauges and customs protocols.
Let's talk about those rail gauges. The Middle East corridor isn't just a metaphor. There is a lot of concrete being poured. The Turkey-Israel dynamic is the most schizophrenic part of this. You mentioned the trade numbers, but how does that survive the political rhetoric? Erdogan has been incredibly vocal against Israel since the April conflict started.
You have to separate the theater of the masses from the engine of the state. Turkey is facing a massive currency crisis and needs to be a regional energy hub to survive. Israel has the gas. The Gulf has the capital. Turkey has the geography. If Erdogan cuts off Israel completely, he cuts off Turkey's path to being the bridge to Europe. That is why we see this weird duality where he condemns the actions in Gaza or Tehran on Monday, and on Tuesday, a Turkish consortium signs a deal for a new port facility in Haifa.
It is almost like a shadow normalization. Is there a historical precedent for this? Where two countries are publicly at odds but privately building massive infrastructure together.
Look at West Germany and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. They were building the Druzhba pipeline while their tanks were facing each other across the Fulda Gap. Economic necessity is a hell of a drug. And the World Bank's $2 billion injection into the Istanbul North Rail project is a huge signal. They don't put that kind of money into a project that they think will be a dead end. They are betting on the Middle East corridor becoming a reality. The vision is to link the Gulf, through Jordan and Israel, up through a revived Syrian-Lebanese corridor, into Turkey, and then into the heart of Europe.
But Syria is the black hole in that map. How do you get a train through a country that has been a proxy battleground for 15 years? I mean, who even owns the tracks in Syria right now?
That is the big question. But look at the trilateral rail understanding that was signed in early 2026 between Syria, Jordan, and Turkey. It is a memorandum to activate the Middle East corridor. This is the first time we have seen Syria even sit at the table for something like this. It suggests that even the Assad regime is looking for an exit strategy from the axis of resistance because Iran can no longer afford to bankroll them. The Gulf states, specifically the UAE and Saudi Arabia, are essentially saying, "We will rebuild your country if you let the trains run through."
It is infrastructure as diplomacy. If you can't agree on the border, agree on the tracks. It's like the ping-pong diplomacy of the 70s, but with freight trains.
Right. And for Israel, this is a massive shift in identity. For 75 years, Israel's primary trade partners were thousands of miles away. If this corridor opens, your primary trade partners are the people you can drive to in 6 hours. That changes the cultural fabric. It moves Israel from being a Western outpost to being the Levantine hub.
Hannah asked if the dream of a modern, progressive, stable, and prosperous Middle East is a pipe dream. If we are talking about this defense tech corridor and railroad diplomacy, it sounds like we are building the hardware for it. But what about the software, the social and political part? Can you really have a progressive alliance with monarchies and autocracies?
The software is the hard part. That is where the Saudi stagnation comes in. MBS is a modernizer, but he is also a realist. He knows he can't bring the Saudi population along for a full normalization without a win on the Palestinian front. But while the grand bargain stays on the shelf, the incremental integration is moving at light speed. We are seeing Saudi venture capital quietly flowing into Israeli cybersecurity firms through third-party hubs in Cyprus and Abu Dhabi. We are seeing shared research on water desalination and desert agriculture.
So, we are building a shared interest zone before we build a peace treaty.
That is the ASEAN model. You create so many layers of interdependence that war becomes a form of self-harm. By 2026, the Israeli economy is so intertwined with the regional energy market that a conflict doesn't just hurt Israel, it hurts the entire Mediterranean basin.
Let's talk about the Lebanon peace again. The Aoun Salaam government. Joseph Aoun, the commander of the Lebanese armed forces, has been the only stable institution in that country for years. If he moves into the presidency, and Nawaf Salam, who has a massive international reputation, becomes prime minister, do we actually see a return of the state that can push back against Hezbollah?
That is the hope, and the 2026 Iran war might have provided the opening. If Hezbollah's patrons in Tehran are preoccupied with their own internal stability and the fallout of the strikes on their nuclear sites, their ability to micromanage Beirut diminishes. If the Lebanese state can offer its people electricity and a stable currency funded by Gulf investment that is contingent on regional stability, the average person in Beirut might decide that a weekend getaway to Haifa is better than another decade of resistance.
It is a bold vision, but we have seen new Middle East visions before. Remember Shimon Peres in the 90s? That didn't end well. What makes 2026 different from 1994? Back then we had the Oslo Accords, the Jordan Peace Treaty. It felt just as inevitable then as you're making it sound now.
The difference is the existential threat and the economic floor. In the 90s, normalization was seen as a nice-to-have luxury of the peace process. It was built on optimism. In 2026, it is built on fear and necessity. It is a must-have for survival against a common regional adversary and a global economic shift. Also, the technology is different. In the 90s, we weren't talking about integrated AI-driven missile defense or shared natural gas fields. The physical ties, the pipelines, and the fiber optic cables are much harder to break than a piece of paper signed on the White House lawn.
That is a fair point. The hardware of peace is more durable than the rhetoric of peace. If you blow up the bridge, you lose your own internet. That's a powerful deterrent.
Well, not exactly. You know what I mean. I want to look at the Europe versus neighborhood pivot some more, because this is a huge psychological shift for Israelis. If you grow up thinking you are a European who just happens to live in a hot climate, your goals are different than if you think of yourself as a Mediterranean power.
It is the startup nation evolving into the scale-up region.
I like that. let's explore that Silicon Sands concept. Because if the next generation of Saudis, Emiratis, and Israelis are working together in shared AI labs in NEOM or tech hubs in Tel Aviv, the normalization happens at the keyboard before it happens at the embassy. We're already seeing the Desert Tech Initiative, where Ben-Gurion University is partnering with institutions in Morocco and the UAE to fight soil salinization. That's a practical, muddy boots kind of piece.
We should also look at the China factor. Because while the US has been the traditional broker here, China is the one building the ports and the rails in many of these countries. How does that affect the regional alliance? Is China the one that finally makes the trains run on time?
That is a massive second-order effect. China doesn't care about the domestic politics of the region, they just want the Belt and Road to function. In a weird way, Chinese investment might be the neutral glue that allows these countries to cooperate without having to align on values. Beijing doesn't ask about human rights or democratic reforms. They ask about the diameter of the tunnel and the weight capacity of the bridge.
So, we have the defense tech corridor, the railway diplomacy, the Silicon Sands tech integration, and the China glue. It is a lot of pieces moving at once.
It is. And it leads back to Hannah's final question. Will there ever be a weekend getaway by train to Beirut or Istanbul?
I want to believe the answer is yes. But let's look at the technical and political barriers that are still standing in the way in this part two of the discussion. Because it is easy to get caught up in the optimistic research papers, but the reality of 100+ kilometers of missing track in a war zone is a very real thing. I mean, we're talking about landmines, different voltage systems for the overhead wires, and the simple fact that some people still don't want that train to arrive.
Let's get into the aha moments where we look at what actually has to happen for that train to leave the station.
Alright, let's get into the nitty-gritty of this Middle East Eurail dream, because as much as I love the idea of catching a sleeper train in Tel Aviv and waking up for coffee in Istanbul, the logistics are, let's say, complicated.
Complicated is an understatement, but it is not impossible. When we talk about the missing link, that 127-kilometer stretch through Syria and Lebanon, we are talking about more than just laying tracks. We are talking about harmonizing rail gauges, customs protocols, and security screenings. But here is the thing most people don't realize. The physical infrastructure in many of these places already exists in a dilapidated state. It is a restoration project as much as a new construction project.
So it is not like we are trying to build a rail line through the Amazon. We are trying to wake up a ghost network. I read somewhere that the old tracks are still visible in parts of the Galilee, in southern Lebanon.
Precisely. Well, I mean, that is the core of it. The Hejaz Railway once connected Damascus to Medina. The Orient Express logic was already there a century ago. What we are seeing now is the digital age version of that. The World Bank's $2 billion injection into Turkey's IN Rail project is the anchor. If you have a functional, high-speed connection from Istanbul to the Syrian border, the economic pressure on the neighbors to plug in becomes immense. It's like having a high-speed internet backbone. Eventually, everyone wants the fiber to reach their house.
But let's play the what-if game. What would it actually take for a train to go from Haifa to Beirut? That is a 3-hour trip tops, right?
Less. The proposed 2019 link was estimated to take under 3 hours. It would cost about $2.3 billion. In the grand scheme of Middle Eastern defense budgets, that is, pocket change, the barrier is entirely political. But look at how ASEAN handled their territorial disputes. They created economic zones that were essentially politics-free. If you create a Levantine rail authority that is managed by a neutral third party, maybe a Gulf-led consortium, or even a Chinese-backed entity, you could bypass some of the recognition issues.
It is the Schengen area of the Middle East, but starting with cargo first. You don't need to recognize a country to let its oranges pass through on a flatbed.
That is exactly how the EU started. People forget the European Union began as the European Coal and Steel Community. It wasn't about peace and love. It was about managing industrial resources so that war became physically impossible because no one controlled the whole supply chain. In the Middle East, 2026, that coal and steel is natural gas and fiber optics. If Israel provides the gas and the Gulf provides the capital, no one wants to blow up the infrastructure because they'd be blowing up their own economy.
So, if Israel is providing the natural gas that powers the Lebanese grid, and the UAE is providing the capital that builds the Syrian rail, and Turkey is providing the gateway to Europe, everyone is holding a piece of everyone else's prosperity.
And that is the aha moment. Normalization doesn't have to be a love fest. It just has to be a mutual hostage situation for economic growth. If the train stops, everyone loses money. That is a much more stable foundation for peace than a diplomatic handshake.
Let's talk about the identity pivot again. You mentioned de-Europeanization. If Israel stops looking at the EU as its primary cultural and economic home, what does it become? Does it become a Mediterranean tiger, like Singapore is an Asian tiger?
That is the most likely trajectory. Think about Singapore. It is a tiny island of high-tech stability in a region that has seen massive upheaval. It succeeded by becoming the service hub and financial anchor for its neighbors. Israel in 2026 is already halfway there. It has the highest density of startups, the most advanced missile defense, and a growing energy sector. If it can pivot away from the "we are a Western outpost" mindset and toward the "we are the regional R&D lab," it becomes indispensable.
But does that mean we lose the European side of the culture? The Eurovision and the Champions League dream? I can't imagine Israelis giving up their obsession with Berlin or London.
Maybe not entirely, but the focus shifts. Instead of, how do we get into the EU market, it becomes, how do we lead the Middle East corridor? And honestly, if you look at the growth rates, the Middle East and Asia are where the action is. The EU is a legacy market. The Gulf is a growth market. Imagine a generation of Israelis who look at Riyadh the way their parents looked at New York, as the place where the big deals happen.
It is like moving from a blue-chip stock that is flatlining to a high-growth tech stock that has a lot of volatility, but a massive upside.
And the volatility is the key. The April 2026 conflict was a volatility event. It was the stress test for the system. And the system didn't break. That is the data point that the World Bank and the UAE are looking at. They are seeing that the Abraham Accords framework is anti-fragile. It actually got stronger under the pressure of the Iran war because it proved the necessity of the alliance. If a 300-missile barrage couldn't kill the Accords, what can?
So, the Silicon Sands idea. We are seeing these defense tech startups. Tell me more about that. Is it just military-industrial complex stuff, or is it broader?
It is much broader. We are talking about dual-use technology. Cybersecurity is the obvious one. If you are a Saudi bank or an Emirati utility company, you are under constant cyber attack from the same actors that are attacking Israel. It only makes sense to use the same Iron Dome for the web that Israel is developing. But it also extends to climate, tech. Desertification is a shared existential threat. Water scarcity is a shared threat. If an Israeli startup develops a new way to pull water out of thin air using solar power, that is a billion-dollar product in Riyadh and Cairo.
That is the practical normalization. It is not about the flag. It is about the faucet.
I love that. Not the flag, but the faucet. And that leads to the weekend getaway test. For a normal person, normalization isn't about a treaty. It is about whether they can take their kids to a beach in Beirut or a bazaar in Istanbul without it being a political statement. We aren't there yet, but the defense tech corridor provides the safety that makes that leisure possible eventually.
We are a long way from that. But if the Middle East corridor rail link through Syria and Jordan gets activated, even just for cargo, the passenger version is only a few years behind. It is the proof of concept phase.
It is, and the Aoun Salaam government in Lebanon is the wild card here. If they can stabilize the currency and the grid using the defense tech corridor as an anchor, Lebanon could flip from being a proxy asset to a regional partner very quickly. The Lebanese people are incredibly entrepreneurial and have a massive diaspora. If you give them a normal economic environment, they will thrive.
So, the Middle East Eurail isn't a pipe dream. It is an infrastructure project with a long lead time.
I mean, yes. It is a reality that is being built right now, one rail sleeper at a time. The World Bank doesn't give out $2 billion for pipe dreams. They give it out for strategic assets. They see a future where a container from the port of Jebel Ali in Dubai can reach the port of Rotterdam without ever touching a ship. That is a game changer for global trade.
Let's look at the China factor again. Because if the US is the security provider, China is the infrastructure provider. Does that create a conflict, or can they coexist in this new Middle East?
That is the great game of the 21st century. But for the regional players, Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, they are getting very good at multi-alignment. They take security from Washington and infrastructure from Beijing. As long as the Middle East corridor functions, they don't feel the need to choose. In fact, having both powers invested in the region's stability is a peace dividend in itself. No one wants to blow up a rail line that both the US and China have a stake in. It's like having two different bodyguards from two different agencies.
It is overlapping interests as a shield.
Precisely. Well, it is the most effective way to prevent a return to the Ring of Fire era. The more nodes you have in the network, tech, energy, rail, air, the more resilient the peace becomes.
So, if we are looking at the actionable insights for our listeners, what should they be watching for in the next 6 to 12 months to see if this dream is actually manifesting?
I think there are three specific signals. One is the Saudi-Israel. Economic agreements that don't make the front page. Watch for joint ventures in third-party countries like Cyprus or Greece. Two is the Syrian rail progress. If we see actual construction or clearing of the old Hejaz tracks, that is a massive go signal. And three is the Lebanese grid. If we see Israeli gas or Gulf-funded solar power stabilizing Beirut, the regional integration is moving from theory to reality.
This is fascinating. It feels like we are watching the birth of a bloc. The Middle East is moving from being a problem to be solved to a market to be integrated.
And for Israel, that is the ultimate win. Not just a military victory, but a normalization of geography, being a neighbor instead of an island.
Normalization of geography. I like that. Let's take a breath and then wrap this up with some concrete takeaways for everyone listening. This has been one of those conversations that makes you look at the map differently. We started with Hannah's question about whether the new Middle East is just a pipe dream, and it feels like the answer is, it is actually becoming a concrete and steel reality, even if the political and diplomatic side is still catching up.
It is a bottom-up integration rather than a top-down one. The 2026 conflict with Iran acted as a catalyst, proving that the old island strategy for Israel is over. The defense tech corridor is the new reality. If you want to track this, don't just look at the speeches at the UN. Look at the trade data. Look at the Istanbul North Rail Crossing progress. Look at the UAE's $35 billion investment fund. Those are the leading indicators.
And for our listeners, the actionable takeaway here is to watch the infrastructure. If the Middle East corridor gets activated, even just for freight, the weekend getaway to Beirut becomes a matter of when, not if. Keep an eye on the Aoun Salam government in Lebanon and the trilateral rail understanding between Syria, Jordan, and Turkey. Those are the missing links that will tell you if the dream is becoming a reality.
Also, keep an eye on the de-Europeanization of the Israeli economy. As Israel pivots toward its neighbors, we are going to see a shift in everything from energy markets to tech collaboration. The Silicon Sands isn't just a catchy phrase. It is a multi-billion dollar shift in the global tech landscape. It changes where the jobs are, where the investment is, and ultimately, where the future is being built.
It is a wild time to be watching this region. The April 2026 conflict might have been the end of an era, but it looks like it was also the beginning of a much more integrated one.
It really does. And I think Hannah's intuition was right. It never made sense for Israel to be an island. The normalization of geography is the most important story of the next decade.
Well, I'm ready for that train ride. I'll bring the snacks, you bring the research papers.
I'll have a stack of railway gauge harmonization reports ready for you.
I'll pass on those, thanks. Anyway, that's all for today's deep dive. Thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the wheels on the track.
And a big thanks to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power this show and keep our digital brains running. This has been my Weird Prompts.
If you're enjoying the show, a quick review on your podcast app helps us reach new listeners and keeps the conversation going. We'll be back soon with another prompt from the vault.
See you next time.
Bye. This episode was produced using Google Gemini 3 Flash. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where all thoughts
go from slow, slow ticks to facts on cue. We change and follow through my weird prompts. That's the close from sloth.